Chapter 3. Sex, Lies and Apartheid. Celeste Cross was sleeping peacefully when she was rudely awakened by shouting. She opened her eyes but was blinded by camera flashes. The 22-year-old Afrikaans woman had nothing on, and while trying to make sense of the commotion, she pulled the blanket over her naked body. It was Saturday night, 17th February 1979, and 14 officers of the South African Police Peeping Tom Squad had just smashed down the door and burst into Cross's Pretoria flat, hoping to catch her in flagrante delicto with a coloured man. But according to Guardian correspondent James Cameron, the police found no flagrante at all. Cross was tucked up in her bed and the coloured man was fast asleep on a couch in the living room. What's more, the coloured man she wasn't having sex with was in fact a white man. Swarthy, to be sure, but a white man nonetheless. His only crime was spending too much time in the sun. The man, John Fraser, was her boyfriend. They had had a fight earlier in the evening, and Cross had banished him to the couch. The officers took Cross and Fraser to Pretoria Police Station, where Fraser, an Afrikaner who had been a paratrooper in the South African Defence Force, a unit only white people could join, hauled out his identity document to prove his whiteness. Even though she hadn't broken any laws, Cross was fired from her job. The incident also caused her to become estranged from her father, who was outraged that she would date a man who didn't look white. Understandably, the incident made Cross, well, furious. Writing about the gaffe, Cameron said, "If ever an administration revealed itself as a bunch of Charlies, albeit cruel and creepy Charlies, it was the South African police." One of apartheid's biggest lies was that sex between white and black people and sex between men was immoral. The NP government went to extraordinary lengths to protect whites' racial purity, but its reputation for blundering incompetence was legendary. In 1927, the Immorality Act banned all illicit carnal intercourse between Europeans and Africans, an offence punishable with prison terms of up to 5 years for men and 4 years for women. This law was the progeny of Justice Minister Tielman Roos, who explained that it was passed to teach poor white men that sex with Africans was a threat to white civilization. Unless interracial couples were caught red-handed, which is to say, with their pants down, proving intercourse was difficult. To overcome this obstacle, the authorities set the bar for conviction low. People could be found guilty on circumstantial evidence. To nab these interracial sex deviants, the police formed a special unit and trained them in the Peeping Tom Protocol. These officers enforced the law rigidly, and hundreds of men and women were convicted every year. The whites in the dock weren't the poor white men Roos wanted to educate. They were Dutch Reformed church ministers, headmasters, attorneys, farmers, and even a prime minister's secretary. Dictation the next day must have been awkward. The Peeping Tom cops were given a manual, presumably without pop-up pictures, that explained how to determine if illicit carnal intercourse had taken place, was taking place, or was about to take place. Their tools of the trade were binoculars, two-way radios, a tape recorder, and a camera. Standard kit for your average stalker. When they suspected that interracial hanky was about to get panky, they were advised not to rush in, but to wait 10 minutes before bursting through the door to catch the offenders in a compromising position. They wanted to apprehend hardened criminals. Bedding and clothes were confiscated for laboratory analysis, and the suspects were taken to the district surgeon. The Peeping Tom cops relied on informers and used black women as bait to trap white men. The Immorality Act combined cold viciousness with extreme pettiness, often with tragic consequences. According to history professor Susan Clausen, white men, often Afrikaners, were aggressively pursued by the police, punished by the courts, and ostracized by their communities. The law tore families apart and caused untold pain for thousands of people whose lives and careers were wrecked because the press named and shamed them. Many Immorality Act victims took their own lives. After a white man in Port Elizabeth learned that police would bring Immorality Act charges against him, he drove his car off the pier and drowned. A father of four in Klerksdorp asphyxiated himself rather than go to court for his affair with a black woman. Shaming, the National Party assumed, would serve as both punishment and deterrent. The regime welcomed the impact of public exposure on countless race traitors and for years greeted reports of their suicides with a shrug, says Clausen. There's the Romeo and Juliet story of Bubbles Mpondo and Yanni Bietre in the 1970s. She was a beautiful black model. He was a white bodybuilder from a conservative Afrikaans family. They were found dead in their Johannesburg flat on 24th August 1978. After shooting Mpondo between the eyes, Bietre shot himself. According to Clausen, the NP saw the Immorality Act suicides as evidence that the men knew they had committed a heinous race crime and that the law was right. But not all people charged under the laws were victims. In 1969, a Peeping Tom cop climbed a tree to peek through the bedroom window of the head of the Department of Social Anthropology at Wits University, John Blacking, and his future wife, Zarina Desai. The couple were arrested, convicted of conspiring to have sex, and given suspended sentences, but the trial backfired for the government. The couple refused to be shamed, says Clausen, and Blacking and Desai's display of moral courage bolstered the anti-apartheid movement, while the news coverage of spying policemen conveyed an image of South Africa being ruled by uptight, sexually repressed, dirty-minded men. NP members seemed particularly fond of feasting on forbidden fruit. One of the first people to be convicted and jailed soon after the Immorality Act was passed was a NAT member of the Transvaal Provincial Council. The Immorality Act's biggest scandal took place in the Platteland town of Excelsior, about 100 kilometres northeast of Bloemfontein. In December 1970, police uncovered a sex ring there involving leading citizens, farmers and businessmen who were senior members of the local NP and dedicated followers of the government's separate development policies, which included the Immorality Act. The men were involved in sexual liaisons with their black domestic workers that included partner swapping. The affairs had gone on for many years, said novelist Zeke Smda, who fictionalized the saga in The Madonna of Excelsior. Apparently, the police had been tipped off to the shenanigans because there were so many half-caste children in town. 7 white men and 15 black women were charged under the act. One man was freed at a preliminary hearing. A second, butcher and town councillor Johannes Karlitz, killed himself while out on bail. The wife of a third left him, and all were ostracized by their 700 fellow townspeople. Some of the white men were charged with sleeping with up to 3 black women, and one farmer had 6 black women all to himself. It promised to be a sensational trial, and local and international reporters converged on the town. But a few minutes before the case began, Percy Utah, the Attorney General of the Orange Free State, and the advocate who had prosecuted the accused in the 1964 Rivonia trial, spoiled the show by withdrawing the charges. The women danced for joy. The men breathed sighs of relief, and the disappointed journalists left without a scandalous story to file. The official reason for the withdrawal of the charges was that too much publicity had intimidated state witnesses. Another theory is that the Nats put pressure on Utah to take a soft line on the case to avoid further embarrassment for the party. From 1950, at least 19,000 people were prosecuted under the Immorality Act, with 11,000 convictions, until it was repealed in 1985. It was another 6 years before the Group Areas Act went the same way. During this time, interracial couples could have sex to their heart's content. They just couldn't live together. Mad about sex. The authorities had been trying to stop sex across the Calabar since the beginning of the 1900s. After the South African War, all 4 British colonies enacted legislation restricting sex between white women and black men. Women in the Transvaal, who voluntarily had unlawful carnal connection with any native, earned 5 years in jail, and the punishment for women in Natal who had sex with Africans was 2 years in jail and 25 lashes. British sex workers were responsible for the law being imposed. They had arrived in the country to cater for British soldiers during the war, but found clients among Africans. The early laws punished only white women and black men. The 1927 Immorality Act banned interracial sex, but not interracial marriage. A central promise of the National Party's 1948 election campaign was finally to stop marriages between black people and white people. In 1949, a year after D.F. Malan's Nats came to power, mixed marriages were banned. And in 1950, an amendment to the Immorality Act criminalized all interracial sex. In 1957, a clause was added prohibiting sexual intercourse or immoral or indecent acts between white people and anyone not white. For Pete's sake. The National Party's most senior member to stray across the color bar was the former cabinet minister Piet Korenhof, nicknamed Pete Promises for promising much and delivering little. At the age of 68, Korenhof, who had overseen forced removals during apartheid, left his wife to live with Marcel Adams, a 24-year-old colored woman he met at a Cape Town nightclub. Korenhof wasn't arrested, convicted, and jailed because, fortunately for him, his relationship took place in 1993, 8 years after the Immorality Act was repealed. Well done. If the settler and frontiersman John Donne had been convicted for every black woman he married, he would have been sentenced to more than 200 years in prison. A friendship blossomed between Donne and King Cetshwayo, who fought several battles against the invading British, notably at Isandlwana in January 1879, which resulted in a famous Zulu victory. Cetshwayo was so taken with Donne, he gave him land, cattle, and two Zulu virgins to be his wives. This last gift upset Catherine, Donne's Cape Malayan wife, but it didn't stop him taking another 46 Zulu wives by official accounts, 62 unofficially. Donne fathered 131 children, and the sprinkling of genes left thousands of pale-skinned Donnes, coal-black Donnes, and in-between Donnes. We like to say there is every kind of race classification in South Africa, and then the Donnes as well, Donne's great-grandson Daniel Donne told the Daily Telegraph in 2014.